You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, welcome to True Hoop with me, Gerard Hechner, and Coach David Thorpe. How are you, sir?
I'm well, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. David, you know, when Henry was on sabbatical for the past 2 years writing his book, I would have people often come to me like, oh, when's Henry going to be back writing stuff, like on the writing articles? When's he going to be back on the pod? I'm like, listen, man, he's writing the book. Like, I don't know, whatever he's done, he's done. But he's back, and he has been writing furiously. I mean, if I just finished writing the book, the last thing I want to do is start writing more things. But, you know, that's Henry.
I wrote a book, and it took me a while to even do Facebook posts. So I was tired.
You didn't want to do Facebook posts.
You know, he worked way harder than me. So, yeah, he's got a lot of energy, that young man.
He sure does. And an article that came out today on Troop.com, you should all be subscribers, is about basketball. And shock of all shocks, David, NBA basketball is a dangerous profession. Players who play this sport and people who play this sport often find themselves injured. And the premise of all this started with Henry just making note that, does it seem like every NBA player is injured right now? Sure does. Seems like a lot of them sure are and have dealt with injuries. And it's a really fantastic article. One of the things that stuck out to me was, over the course of any NBA season, roughly 56% of the players, which is more than half, will get injured throughout the course of play. I mean, what an astonishing number.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, heck, I remember even as a young high school coach hearing that, you know, a good percentage of players get hurt. It's a dangerous sport. I thought the article was beyond brilliant, and literally I want to send it to everyone I know. I'm not kidding. Anyone in the business. Mm-hmm. The reason why I feel that way is because I don't think the people in charge of the league value the players' bodies the way they should. It's not news to me that it's a dangerous sport. The alarming thing is that we have really powerful people in the NBA acting as if rest isn't a weapon, and that it's nonsensical to me and quite dangerous, actually.
It's beyond dangerous. And you're right. They don't care about the players. You know, these billionaires and oligarchs we were talking about off air before we came on that own these teams, these players are like, it's a conveyor belt for them. All right. Someone gets hurt. Who cares? I have a draft coming up in June. I'll just get a new one. Right. I'll get more. And that is the callous nature within which a lot of these owners approach this sport. And when Henry's book comes out next year, you know, there'll be some sort of, like, you know, talk around that, right? About how players, and, you know, this is a player who's admitted this publicly in numerous places, how a team's arcane medical staff caused him further injury, that being Grant Hill, you know, when he was with Detroit, how, you know, sort of routine injuries led to staph infections and, like, really on things that really could have ended his life. And it's just, it's cruel, right? We look at the NBA schedule, which we discuss all the time. That is just, we know that's not right. I mean, it's just, there's every possible piece of scientific data will tell you that. You know, in that piece that Henry wrote, there's a researcher, a PhD researcher, and in her paper about NBA players, it says, research suggested that the mechanism for ACL injuries, and this is just one type of injury, is more likely to occur in fatigue states. On average, increases in performance load were positively associated with higher injury risk. Similarly, one could interpret that results as reductions in performance load being associated with a lower injury risk. And another quote, rest showed that the strongest effect of all variables studied. Simply not playing in back-to-back games can reduce the probability of injury by almost 16% for the average player. Whereas the topic of player rest is becoming increasingly controversial for basketball fans and media, the data support is its utility in preventing injuries. But David, if I hear Adam Silver and Joe Dumars tell me, no science says rest prevents injuries. And that, to me, that is a league that is engaging in outright lies and falsehoods, and to your point, not caring about the people who matter most, the people on the floor playing the games.
So when Patrick Beverley ran into Russell Westbrook's knee in the playoffs mm-hmm. of, I don't remember what year it was, the Thunder had won the West. Mm-hmm. It was during LeBron's run in Miami.
2013.
So in that,
probably sounds about right.
In that, yeah, that sounds about right. That derailed the Thunder that season. I talked to Henry about it, and I said, he made a comment about Westbrook being overused all year, and I said, well, what does that matter? Beverley ran into his knee with his knee when I remember the play like it was yesterday. He was mm-hmm. trying to call a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
Houston went on a little run.
Yep.
So he went to half court, called timeout. Beverley tried to shoot the gap mm-hmm. and knock it away. It was just a reckless play. It wasn't very dirty. Reckless. It was reckless. And I said, what does overuse have to do with that? And Henry explained to me that basically our nervous system, the speed at which you feel pain in your brain is faster when you're not drunk, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So he likened it to drunk driving. The reason why drunk drivers are more dangerous than the average driver or that same driver not drunk is their nervous system's moving faster. You're more aware quickly. I feel the same way. I just had to drive, almost 8 hours from Tallahassee to East Orlando to Clearwater. My wife helped me some. I definitely felt like I was not as aware of the road the way I am when I'm completely awake.
Mm-hmm.
Being drunk makes it worse. All right. So it's just that message of, hey, you're feeling pain in your knee. Adjust it. Move. Whatever. It's just happening milliseconds later. And that caused more damage. Same as a drunk driver wouldn't make that same accident if he was sober. All right. So in that scenario, our leaders in the NBA are saying to the players, just keep drinking and driving. You'll be okay. That's what we're talking about here. And so we have a lot of drunk drivers on the road. In this case, on the basketball court. That doesn't mean we don't see incredible play. We do. I would argue that some of the better athletic performances we're watching, my bet is they're either super young and or they've got their own people training them, mm-hmm. their own physios. I know for a fact, in some cases, that's what's happening. I know those players because I know their physio. Mm-hmm. I know the players. They're getting extra help to make sure they're recovering. So it's sad that they have to do that. Mm-hmm. I also think there are some teams that are doing a better job than others at managing it. Now, rest is the best. Mm-hmm. But they're doing the best they can. It's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. It's like only taking two shots instead of four shots, in a bar.
Yep.
I'd rather you take no shots.
Right.
But two is better than four if you want to stay relatively sober. So it's alarming that the article is great. And I should say this. I get no financial reward from Henry's book when it comes out. Right. Zero. I also am close enough with him where I don't have to say nice things about him and still feel like we're going to be great friends. The book is a force of nature.
It is.
The book is an absolute game changer. Henry, it's going to be hard. I have an idea of what he might do next. He doesn't know for sure. It's going to be hard to beat this. Let me tell you something. It is fucking incredible.
Yeah.
I have to fly in a plane. I'm not going to go into details, but soon enough, I'll be on an airplane. I'm bringing this with me. I can't wait because I'm not done yet. Yeah. It's really incredible. And it's something I want to give to everyone that I know as a gift. Once it's out there, because it's game changing for us, not to mention our athletes.
Without question. And again, same. I texted this to Henry. I was like, my goal is to help you make this book a number one bestseller. I am not done with it yet either. And yes,
gotta be.
We are lucky because we got advanced copies, which we probably shouldn't have, but that's a different story. It's not just about athletes, about NBA athletes, which they're part of it. It's about all of us. Anyone who has a body and the ability to move. How can we do better with this one? We only have one of these, right? This one thing that we have to live life with. How can we make it hurt less?
One body, one life.
Correct.
Right, one body, one life, yeah.
And that's what this book is about. And it's really, I mean, I told him before I even got the advanced copy, I said, look, this, if the NBA were smart and if it's, you know, we talk about competitive balance, right? Which ownership is going to like sort of find the next frontier. Well, this is the next frontier, right? Actually treating your athletes properly and knowing, okay, how much rest is needed, how much training is needed. All the team that adopts this book and says, okay, I'm with you. We're doing this. That's the team that's going to be light years ahead. Who's going to do it? I don't know. We have our feelings about how these oligarchs are in general. We, you know, we question a lot of their decision making, but this is really the next frontier to me in how you make your athletes better.
It's going to be that, or it's going to be the team that tells their players, we're just not going to spend the money. You should. So go hire your own people and do your own thing. And we'll all benefit from it. And we're getting to a point now where most of these players can afford it.
For sure.
When I say most of these players, the lion's share easily can afford an extra, even if it costs you $40,000 a year for your own guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm making up the number. I have no idea what they cost.
Right.
I've never asked. It's valuable stuff. And but it only mitigates. It doesn't solve.
Correct.
When we overplay these guys the way we do. Mm-hmm. But the big picture is, as Henry writes, the idea that it's not even the case that these players are at risk, and we see it. We're watching players. I watched OKC play the other night. No Jalen Williams. Mm-hmm. Ben Mathurin, if you're a Pacers fan, he's done.
Out for the season.
And Henry lists all. Jalen Williams will be back. Mm-hmm. Ben Mathurin won't be. But Joel Embiid. I just saw the Sixers. I saw a tweet, all the Sixers' best lineups for the season, all Joel Embiid.
Obviously.
I mean, there's some monstrous pluses in there.
No doubt.
He ain't playing. Maybe he'll be back in the playoffs, and how good will he be? We don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Same with Kat. I mean, Steph's out right now. LeBron's been, you know, in the article today, Henry talked about, you know, LeBron got that ankle injury, that ankle that he's hurt at least a dozen times that we know of. It's the more you do this, right, wear and tear on the body, the less likelihood it has of coming back. And we know, right, the best predictor of future injury is previous injury, right? That's just how this stuff tends to work.
I saw you two in Vegas, as you know, at the Sphere recently. And Edge and the bass player were the same. Bono was there. They had a replacement, I want to say a drummer. I think the guy didn't make the trip to Vegas. He's not health-wise. He's not well. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know the difference. I don't follow you two that closely. If Bono hadn't been there, I'd have noticed the difference. I'm not even sure if it would have mattered if Edge was there or not. Definitely Bono. We're missing Bonos all over the place, and we're missing drummers. Mm-hmm. It's not a good product compared to what it could be. Yeah.
Especially given where we are in the season, David. This is supposed to, we're heading towards the most important time on our calendar. This is when we're supposed to see the best basketball.
And didn't Kawhi just miss a game with a bad back?
He has back spasms, and he's been playing all season, like, and playing well. And I don't know the extent of Kawhi's medical history, but what a surprise to me. The one season where you're actually gearing towards playing the most you've played in the last few years.
Yeah.
Well, now you're hurt now. Like, you know, it's a thing, right? And there's a better way. We all know it. You know, will they change? Odds are likely not, but is what it is. David, I know you didn't see this because you don't pay attention to such things. I don't really pay attention to this either, but I only saw because I opened up Twitter. So there was this thing going around, and it was younger generation people, right? So people born in the 2000s, let's say. And they were trying to say, you know, who's the GOAT basketball player? And that's we did our True Hoop top five, God, 4 years ago now, so long ago, who we had up there. And we all had consensus, the same two people in the top two. And this is who this debate is about. It's Michael Jordan and LeBron James. And there's some 2000s TikToker was basically pulling up video about how Michael Jordan had no left hand. They're like, look, there's no left. How are you going to tell me this guy's better than LeBron James when he had no left hand? And, like, you know, all these cherry pick things that they do. And you and I agree that comparing players across eras is just a foolhardy mission. And even players in eras as close as LeBron and Michael, it's just the game was different. Be that as it may, it sparked this whole Twitter firestorm about who's better, who's this, who's that, whatever. And it had me thinking about basketball and the evolution of the game, JJ Redick's podcast, and Devin Booker was just on recently. And the game, it's just like life, it evolves over time, right? Like it used to be nobody had a left hand in 1940 unless you were left-handed, right? Everyone only went one way.
Did you ever see the fish that saved Pittsburgh?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. J, yes, correct. In the
if when I watched it, which was not in the movie theater, but I saw it not that long after it came out,
right?
And I was young. He's much older than me. It bothered me then, and I was a kid. Like he has no left hand at all. You can't go left with your right hand against real defense.
Correct.
But he couldn't do it. Yeah. Go on. I'm sorry.
No. You're fine. And you know, and it used to be that you had 7-foot stiffs out there who really couldn't move or do anything, but they were huge and they just clogged up the paint, so you couldn't go in there. And over time, oh, these 7-footers can move a little bit. Oh, there's this dude, Shaq, who's so, when he first came out of LSU, when he was lean and super fast and could sprint the floor, you're like, oh my God, what the hell is that? Then he just put on weight and just became like this huge immovable mountain in the middle. But either way, guys have changed. And you had Dirk and you had KD. It's like, wow. And then now Wemby, who we'll talk about later. It's evolution, right? Same thing with the 3-point line. It used to be, oh, this stupid gimmick thing. We only use the end of games when we're down. We got to get three. Now, Steph Curry changed it. Dame Lillard, guys like that, you got to guard them the minute they walk in the gym because they can pull up from anywhere and hit with consistent ability. And so I was wondering, David, when you look at basketball and you look at its evolution, and you've been watching the game a long time, how has the evolution hit you and how has it changed the way you work with your players?
It's a great question. So yeah, my first, other than the coaching my fraternity team, which was not a bunch of great players, we were good. My first coaching job was 1987. And on our varsity, we had some really talented players and we would do a ton of ball handling work. The 3-point shot was nationally instituted into the game that same year. So I've only known the 3-point line in effect as a coach. I was 22. We definitely spent some time on shooting. It wasn't anything close to what it is now. We used to talk about, you know, inside out, which is, by the way, not a bad thing. Go inside out. But if you're wide open from three, you don't have to go inside out. You can just shoot it anyway. That just normally teams are guarding you there. I'm going to try to give you a smart answer here because I did not know you were asking me that question. but I have an answer. I would say the single biggest evolution that's occurred in this game is our imagination of what's possible and efficient. Mm-hmm. So there were always players that could do. I mean, I was shooting long. We would play on the side full court. Think of a full court, and you have two side courts. Mm-hmm. I played in the projects pretty much 6 days a week when I was in college. But I would play one on one during the day with my buddy Mark, my buddy Bird, and I would shoot nearly half court shots, which were probably 30 footers because it wasn't really half court. But I would never have done that when we were playing real 5-on-5 to win a game, or you have to sit for three games right. because you don't have downs, because you didn't do that. And some of the go up right, come to your left hand, the floaters, all these kinds of things people would do on occasion, but they weren't the bread and butter of our game offensively. They are now. Mm-hmm. So everything you're seeing in a game has been done before. It just wasn't meat and potatoes. It was the rare dessert, and now it's meat and potatoes. The floater is a normal part of the game. The right foot, right hand, left foot, left hand. That was Steve Nash is the first one that I remember really doing it. Mark Price made the split screens, kind of a staple that we all see everywhere now. It's everyone can do the crossover and the inside out cross and the spin dribbles. Siakam 6'9" spin is famous. That wasn't happening, but on occasion before. And so now as a coach of young players, when you have that, you're not putting them in nearly the same tight box that you once would have even 30 years ago, 20 years ago, if you're a good coach,
yeah,
everything becomes much more possible. I also think, because we know what we can do with athletes, you're going to see 6'1" and 6'2" guys that you don't think would be necessarily be dunking or dunking because they believe that they can because of social media and because of SportsCenter and highlights. Well, that guy looks like me and he's punching it. And now all of a sudden I've got that spark in my head, that little light of, hey, maybe I should work on that more and I can do it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now we have a situation where this is so good, Gerard. I just was watching Spoelstra talk about their game against Denver last night. Mm-hmm. I really recommend you look it up on YouTube. He's describing Bam Adebayo and why he's arguing why Bam should be defensive player of the year.
I just saw it before we came on. Okay. Yeah, because he's the only one who takes Jokic one all the stuff. Yep.
Right. But then he starts to exactly right. But then he just describing what that entails.
Yeah.
It's Jokic starts posting him up. Jokic at the top of the key because they play that game there. And then he gets to his pick and roll game. And then he gets to his two-man game with Murray. And all those flavors. Well, Jokic can do all of it. Okay. Bam can do a lot. Bam can't shoot. But Bam is a very good offensive player. He's got a big set of skills. Mm-hmm. We're going to just see this more and more and more. It used to be, I coached a really talented 6'10 center, very athletic kid from a wealthy family, but they could afford to hire me to work with him. Great passer. Howard Garfinkel once said to me, he's the best passing big I've seen since Bill Walton. That's high praise.
High praise.
But that's where it was limited, is he didn't really shoot the three. I didn't have him shoot the three. He could really shoot around the rim, right or left-handed. We would do a drill. It's called the Kevin McHale drill, where you tip the ball up off the board over and over and over while your other hand is touching the rim. Not easy. I make all my 6'10 and taller
guys do it.
But he was doing it 50 times before tipping it in, and he was 16 years old. But not the handle stuff and not the variety of scoring things. Jokic's floater is sublime. But that's going to catch on. And 10 years from now, I hope, I don't know if I'm working anymore, probably, but certainly hope to be alive. You're going to see more guys do it. They'll be so much better than everyone else, but more guys will have that in their game. There'll be more. Valanciunas is a really gifted offensive player. He doesn't have the kind of shit Jokic does, but Valanciunas' son will. Or daughter. Mm-hmm. So that's where the games, in my opinion, evolved the most. And then because of that, our athletes have had no choice but to evolve, as our coaches have had to, because we have to guard these people that can do all these things.
Oh, and we're going to get to that a little bit later, too. And we talk about this era being positionless, David. So I know in your gym now, I don't know if you did this back in the day, big men would do big men things, quote unquote, and little guys would do little guy things. I feel like now everyone does everything, right? There is no, oh, you only do this and you only do that.
Yeah. Listen, I am not claiming to be smart in almost any facet of this world, but when it comes to basketball, I've been pretty smart. So we taught our players everything. I had, I've talked about Dimitri Hill before, 6'6", 300-pound ninth grader. In the offseason, I made him play point guard, in part because I wanted him to see what it was like to feed the post, because that would make him better at being a receiver down there. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to teach him the game. So I was criticized for it. I had old white dudes, as you can imagine, mostly old white dudes, saying, man, if I was coaching that big bitch, he would never leave the low post. Of course, I was thinking, well, then he wouldn't be playing for you.
Correct.
Because he's having a lot of fun playing for me. By the time he's a senior year, he's leading the SEC in scoring, shooting threes and everything. Because we let him play basketball. It's a fun game. It's a fun game. Don't make him play classical music. It's supposed to be jazz. Mm-hmm. But you're right. And so now there's still old school coaches that don't let their...
Really?
It's terrible. Yes.
What the hell does this?
Because here's why it's so terrible, Gerard. It's because an idealist high school. I have a very... we have a new recruiting business I told you about. We help young players. I've got this really talented 6'4 kid. He's a guard, he's going to play varsity starting his sophomore year. It's a big time program, but on his JV team, he's the tallest guy.
So he plays center.
Want to guess where he's playing? God. Center. So I have him embracing it. Right. I have him in, right now. I'm still helping these young players. I hope to grow the business to the point where it won't be me anymore, so I can focus on the world's best players. But I'm learning still. I'm always learning, and so I said to embrace it. I value guards that know how to be tough. I value it, and not to go into a tangent, but the other day, I don't remember what game it was, but someone was playing the Pacers, and they're beating the shit out of Indiana inside. Come out first play of the third quarter, pretty much first play. Someone shoots the ball, and Andrew Nembhard comes flying in and just floors the center for the other team. They got called for a foul, but he set a tone. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm fucking hitting people. Well, he isn't an American, but he played soccer. You have to hit people in soccer, as you know well,
yep,
in Canada. I value that. So I told this young man, learn how to fight with the big boys, it will help you when you become a full-time guard. He'll be a college player for sure. And but still, that coach, come on, coach. I don't care if you defend fives.
Right, right.
But don't make him play in the low post offensively. It's not like he always did that. But I also, it's Jazz.
Right.
Here's how you can find ways to score from the perimeter before he yells at you to get the ball in, to get inside.
Get
you
into know? The post.
We are getting better. Right? We are getting better collectively as coaches globally at letting these guys. Let me tell you something. A guard that knows how to back people down is tough.
Well, we see in the NBA all the time. Those power guards that they can bury you under the rim. Good luck.
I mean, all the time.
You know, we know them all, right? Jrue Holiday, Derek White, like all these really strong guards. It's like, man. Not only can they back you down, they are hard to back down in turn, right? Because they've learned those things. It's fascinating. Right. And this is this all got me thinking too, this evolution and everything. And I don't know if you did see this, I put in the rundown. Shaq was on his podcast.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Talking about Rudy Gobert. And you know, Rudy, for a variety of reasons, gets shit on by not just current players with former players. And I'm a firm believer. A large part of that is because he's French, and a lot of American players still hold that like European soft nonsense in their head, even though the world's best player is not American. And right. That dude ain't soft. Right. Like, and they all know it. Right. Talk about how Bam, probably the best, one of the best defensive big men in the league. He has trouble guarding that dude, and Bam's a tough SOB, right? Like, doesn't matter. That guy is so tough, so skilled. Like, who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. And it's this idea that you and I talk about all the time. American inner cities aren't the only tough places in the world, right? Like, you go all over the, like, you grew up in a war-torn country. That's pretty tough, right? Like, that's pretty tough.
I think I told this once before. When I was first coaching, our kids were from the worst projects in St. Pete. Two of the worst projects. Definitely the worst, and then one of the worst. It's much, much better now down there. But, we brought over 2 years in a row Serbians because they were in a civil war. Now, we were hoping they'd be better at basketball, and they weren't. But the point my late head coach and I would talk about is it's good for our guys to see, as bad as their projects are, it's not a civil war. Our kids would watch at 6 o'clock nightly news sometimes because very often back then, this was early 90s,
yep.
That's what led the news.
Correct.
And they were looking to see what city it was because it wasn't like we had no internet.
No.
You if you didn't hear from home, you didn't know. And I've also coached really wealthy kids of different races and ethnicities, whatever, who fucking were tough as nails. Tough. There's a lot to what makes a tough guy, whatever. And it's not unique to any one thing.
That's correct. And so, Rudy has that sort of that label, right? And of course, when he didn't make All-Star that year, he cried. Draymond made fun of him. Draymond put him in a rear naked chokehold earlier this season. All the things that we know, right? So Shaq gets on and he's like talking about Rudy's defense. And he's like, all that weak side shot blocking stuff is great. But, you know, you can't tell me like playing great defense is locking up your man. Hold Jokic to single digits and single digit rebounds. And I'm like, well, Shaq, nobody's holding Jokic. Matter of fact, you aren't holding Jokic to single digit points and rebounds either.
There's a more critical thing to say than that, which is this is not a game of one-on-one.
Correct.
This is not five games of one-on-one.
Correct.
It's one game of 5-on-5. And Shaq, you just kind of expose yourself, man. The game is, you would not have done well in this game because help is legal now.
Correct.
It wasn't legal so much in part of his career. I don't remember when the rules changed, but my job is to keep them from scoring, not my guy.
Correct. And it takes into account people's – and the reason why I wanted to bring this up, David, is because Shaq is a very popular, great former player.
Yep.
His opinion carries weight. So if he says something, a casual fan was like, well, Shaq knows more basketball than I do. He must be right about Rudy. And it's like, no, he's actually wrong, right? Because what he's not taking into account is – the fact that the way the Jazz played defense, they had, I'm being nice, suspect perimeter defenders on that squad to downright terrible. But the fact that Rudy was there to cover for all that, had that being the top defensive team in the league by regular season metrics every year he was there because he was such a looming help defender and presence. That's what had the number one defense. Now, in the playoffs, it wasn't that Rudy got exposed so much as the Jazz got exposed, right? Because when a team has a weak And that's the only team they're playing. Oh, Donovan Mitchell can't guard. Bogdanovich can't. All these guys can't guard on the perimeter. No problem. Penetrate, kick, because Rudy's going to have to help. Flip the ball out to the corner. Wide open there. He's got to run out now from the paint to the three-point. Not enough time. We'll score. And that was largely the Jazz's problem, right? Was that Rudy couldn't cover everybody, and it got exposed. And I just think that when former players, and Shaq knows better, but it's part of the shtick. When they do things like that, that hurts overall the game and hurts the way that fans learn about the game.
Agreed. Rudy's biggest problem is he couldn't make the other team pay defensively.
Correct.
For his size. Mm-hmm. So let's just think of it this way. If Rudy could play offense the way Shaq did, but then play defense the way Rudy did, mm-hmm. The Jazz would have won the championship because he would have made you pay for going small. Mm-hmm. Because Shaq would have murdered all of the small guys.
Correct.
So he couldn't. He just didn't have the great hands. He didn't really have, he doesn't have the size to mm-hmm. do necessarily. We could pick some holes into what
right.
Quinn Snyder was doing. I agree with your overall assessment. It's unfortunate that it's not intelligent talk. I think he's an intelligent man. He isn't like a lot of TV. He's trying to appeal to the masses. And there's lots of guys in barbershops and bars saying, I knew it. And they're just wrong. They're just wrong. The same people who are saying, these guys don't need rest. you can't fight. Can't you be logical with people that are illogical?
No. And it's tough because a large part of this stuff too, David, is when you are, and this goes back to what we started with the Jordan comparison, et cetera, right? There is a, when you were there, and you watched and experienced it, and someone after you says, but no, look, this person is better. In some ways, the person who's defending their position of the previous generation, you're in some ways feeling like their position, their lived experiences are invalidated, right? It's like, what are you telling me? That what I saw with my eyes wasn't true? And it's like, no, what you saw with your eyes were very true. At that point, that was the case. He was the best. Not now, right? Like it's well, just, it
and,
changes.
And let's, right, so... I can go watch a Bulls game one time on YouTube and I'll see about Jordan's left hand. Mm-hmm. But we are not trying to evaluate players in a vacuum.
Correct.
In other words, we have to factor in the result of the possessions. And so it doesn't matter what hand Jordan used or didn't use if he was winning possessions like no one was ever winning before. And he was. He did.
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
I don't care. Zion doesn't have much of a right hand. It doesn't matter. Right. He's super gifted that way. You could argue that Kareem didn't have a great counter to a skyhook.
It Who was cares? Okay.
It didn't matter. He could keep getting to a skyhook. And so now the rule changes have some impact on this because a player that can always beat you one way now may face a second help, mm-hmm. Helper earlier than he may have before because the rule changes. And so now that factors in, which is where the evolution part comes in because they have forced to learn other things now in order to continue to win possessions.
You dropped in our chat today that you did something where you watched an old basketball game, a 1987 Lakers Celtics
last
game.
Night.
And then you were watching Lakers Kings last night. And again, from your basketball eyes, can you just educate our audience briefly on the difference in what you saw in very basic terms in those two games.
Let me set the stage first for 10 seconds. I watched games from 7 a.m. till 10:30 and I was done. And I have a very busy weekend coming. And I said, you know what? I'm going to have two fingers of a very good añejo, a brand that I call Three Amigos, and because I won't drink it all on the weekend. And I'm going to watch something and just get my mind off basketball. And then I thought, well, I want to watch some post game. I like watching the post game press conferences mm-hmm. sometimes. Like we saw with Spo.
Yep.
I didn't watch Spo last night, but and then I just thought, wait a second, what is this over here? Because it gives you recommendations, the algorithm. Yeah, yeah. I do watch a lot of basketball.
It gives you and more basketball.
For some
to
reason,
watch.
It was Lakers Celtics 87. I'm like, me and the Three Amigos, and yeah, we're like, yeah, let's do it. I guarantee you with 100% certainty, I watched this game when it was out in 1987. Right. I just graduated college when it happened. And yeah, so the Lakers and the Celtics, five dudes are running into the paint, running into the paint, running into the paint. Everyone's in the paint all the time. You can often count 8 to 10 feet in the paint, pretty much every position defensively. So then I thought, oh, this is interesting. The Lakers are playing now against a different team, mm-hmm. against the Kings. Mm-hmm. And you're maybe going to have one offensive, defensive player around the paint in most cases to start the possession. It's just so expanded. As we know, we've talked about this before, but it was just evident again that it's just a very, very different landscape. And I know this from coaching myself. I used to do a lot. If you look back at my old playbooks, I did a lot of different, I had a lot of similar actions from different starting positions. So we would do what we call a pro set, which was a guy, the wings would be below the block. And then I'd have my two bigs, maybe a foot above the block. So there'd be some space there. And then we'd run whatever action we want to do. Then we'd have a stack set. Mm-hmm. So I would have them stacked together on the top of the block and the bottom of the block on both sides. And then it would have maybe a guy on the wing, a guy on the block on one side, two guys on the block on the other. But we'd all rerun the same actions just from different formations. That was how we did it. But we always had normally two or three guys in the paint to start the possession. That is not what I'd be doing and did not do that at all. When I coached my son's sixth grade team, we started out five out. We always started five out and then we played from there. We tried to spread you out to begin with and then we do different things. Yeah. And that was when they was the sixth grader. So this was like 2013.
And a large reason for that, folks, is that in 87, the players on a basketball court in the NBA that were all skilled and could do everything was far limited to what it is now. Now on an NBA roster, everybody can do just about everything. So because of that, you have more things you have to worry about and defend, right? Oh man, this center can also step out the three and oh crap. Okay. I got to think about that too. This power forward can do this, this, and this. There's all, and it's really positionless. As we say, we got five guys who can just play basketball versus, well, this one guy, I know these two guys are going to stand here because they really can't do much else outside of this 5 foot area outside of the rim. So that makes it harder, right? And then the athleticism has increased, all the different things. Like, basketball has always been a hard game. As we've evolved, it's just gotten harder and harder and harder. All right, folks, we'll be back after a brief commercial break. All right, David, so speaking of basketball being hard and difficult, and I know this is something near and dear to your heart, the NBA, its competition committee, is trying to figure out a way to make defense more possible, to help defenders play defense better. They've been hearing the cries from the fans, too easy, letting these guys get away with murder. They can just score whenever they want. We got to make defense tougher. And as someone who prepares players to play both sides of the floor, obviously, but to guard some of the best players in the world, it's a difficult thing. And I imagine that you have some ideas on how the NBA can help make defense more possible and more make it more fair than it is. Because you would probably agree that it is heavily slanted towards offensive players, particularly superstar offensive players. So I bet the first thing you would say is have more consistency by the refs, but that's a different conversation for a different day. How would you work on making defense more possible in the NBA?
So they're already doing it. We've seen, I think even Spoelstra in his press, if you saw it, Spoelstra talked about how it's happening right now. He said, I didn't get the memo. And I don't think he was being funny. I didn't get the memo saying that we're going to start calling less fouls on contact than we did before. But it's very evident to me. He noticed it too. Probably everyone has. Players that I've spoken to have admitted, I don't know if I'm getting better at not fouling or they just aren't calling it. And I had to tell them in most cases, they're just not calling it. You're doing the same thing. It's still not consistent every night, which is an issue. But there's no doubt that you can impede players more with your body, be more physical, and not have a foul called. What you can't do is use your hands still too much. They're going to call that. I call it narrowing up. So for those people watching as opposed to listening, imagine spreading your arms pretty wide and just moving my feet and using my body to impede progress some. That normally isn't going to be called a foul. Not often anyway, unless maybe it's against the star. Obviously, it's a whole separate thing. I narrow in and kind of grab their core and hold onto them. They're calling that a foul almost every time. I call that an absolute. Mm-hmm. It's an automatic foul. So I often will text my players that exact thing, even sometimes at halftime. You can't get narrow when they're driving because if I'm an offensive player, I'm going to run into your hands. narrow to your body, and they're going to call that a foul almost every time. One of the other things they can do, which I don't know that they're doing it now, is do a better job policing illegal screens. Advantage to the offense. There are times where it's really bad. I don't think it's so bad now, but it can get better. You can really make sure, because we have ghost screens and beer screens and blur screens. Have you heard the term blur screen?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's for me.
Yep.
Blur screen. And they're not, but they're not really screening anyone.
Right.
Sometimes they do. That should be a foul. If you're running and hitting someone and glancing off them, that's probably a foul. So we got to clean that up a little bit, make it better for defenses. If they're going to hit someone on the move, it's a foul. If you're not going to hit them, move all you want and just fake hit them, and that's fine, which is what a blur screen should be. But you clean that up, I think you would help a lot. Everyone's talking about hand checks. In the old days, there were no hand checks because nobody guarded anyone out there. What they would do, though, is as you drove, they would get their hands on you in space. And that isn't allowed, as I said. So if you start allowing a little bit of that without extending, you're definitely going to have less points, in part because there'll be less free throws. So quickest way to get the point total down, listen, when referees were fixing games for totals, just call more fouls.
Correct.
All you have to do is call more fouls. So if I call less fouls, we'll have scoring down. It also will mean defenses would be – I mean, I had a player tell me the other day. I showed him on film. This guy's a very tall, long player, and he kept his hands down against the guy shooting at the rim, and he made it. And after the game, I said, I suspect it was because you were afraid to get a foul. He's like, yeah, I just got called for one. It was my second. It was first half. I don't get my third. And if I get my hands straight up, there's still a chance they're going to call a foul. If I just keep them down, they won't. I had no argue with him on that. Right. I understand what he's saying. So if you have less fouls, you have guys less worried about getting their hands up, which means they'll impede those shooting numbers. The percentages will go down even more.
Absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned that it's kind of happening now. Zion was asked about this. I want to say Tuesday night they played. Or did they play last night? Most recent game. And the reporter said, Zion, I'm not trying to get you in trouble, but have you noticed a change in the officiating? And Zion responded, in terms of free throws. He's like, and he's joking, tongue in cheek. Wow, you're a liar. You are trying to get me in trouble. He's like, no, I'm kidding. He's like, I guess what I would say is the playoffs are coming. So they're changing up a bit. He's like, every veteran has told me that all the fouls that get called in the regular season, they won't get called in the playoffs. So it seems like they're getting themselves ready for playoffs. So how much of it is that we, in a sense, have two different types of games? In the postseason, refs tend to allow things a little bit more than they do in the regular season.
You know, I think there's – Henry knows it better than I. I think there might be some studies that did not show that. That doesn't mean – I mean, studies can be wrong. And as someone who knows referees, like, they're human beings. It might just be that they were told, blow everything you can. We want to get point totals up. And it just doesn't sit right with them. And they're just like, you know what? I know I'm not calling this in the playoffs. Let me start training my eye for it now. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a switch you can easily flip.
Right.
You're reacting fast. I still think there's too many delayed calls. And yeah. I don't mind it if it just takes an extra millisecond for that impulse to go into your lips to blow. I don't like it when you're waiting for the result. That's my problem.
I agree.
I don't like that.
That is a situation.
It's a foul. End of story.
That's the situation we have in world football, right? Where a ref's like, oh, I'm gonna whistle here. I'm going to wait to see how the play. But I'm like, wait, if it wasn't, why does it matter if it results in a goal? That shouldn't, if it was a foul, then call it then. Why does it matter later? Right.
Right. I really don't like that at all. And because sometimes they just forget to call.
Right.
In soccer, especially.
Yeah. Right.
Why don't you give me a start on soccer? I don't
want to go. But no, it's the delayed call, and I think that bothers players a lot, is that when the call comes, because the players they're moving, right, going off instincts. They don't hear the whistle. They're ready to run back down. Wait, what if you saw it 5 seconds ago? What changed in those 5 seconds? That's a long delay from, oh, my brain, too. And that's your point. They were watching to see what would happen. So what if he didn't? So much of it, too, David, is like reffing what you assume to be a foul. Oh, a player fell. He must have got hit. Well, maybe he tripped over his own feet. Like, that happens, right? Just because someone ran to the rim and they fell doesn't mean the defender hit them. They just fell.
Years ago, Henry asked me on a True Hoop TV thing way back, you know, 10 years ago, what would be the best advice for these referees? And I said, call what you see. That means you have to see the contact. Don't call the result, the consequence. Last night I was watching a G League game and a player is driving and barely hit his defender in the chest. It definitely wouldn't have been a call, but the player threw his head back like he was John F. Kennedy getting shot.
Yep.
And right away drew the foul. The camera crew only caught it like one time, but I watched it on Synergy. The guy didn't get touched in the head. He just threw his head back. And so this happens a lot. We see it
all the time.
I wish official would do, it's not easy to do, but if you don't see the contact of the head, don't call it just because the guy flew back. I think you're better off just call what you see and get better at that.
Henry calls it ref games, and we see it especially with the older players. They are so good at this. And you'll, because we have so many cameras now, you'll see the angle. This happened in the Kings game last night with LeBron flung his head back. I'm like, LeBron, that hand was nowhere near your head, my friend. Like, not even like in the same neighborhood. But he flings back. Oh my God. I'm like, guys, come on. You gotta be better about this stuff. Good actors, these guys. Really, really good actors. We did a story on True last week about who the current best player in the world is. The three of us, sans Travis, he said Jokic, which we don't, you know, we don't fault them for that. We call it SGA.
If he wanted to be the player, he would be. He just hasn't wanted to be.
Correct.
Why am I going to give an award he doesn't want?
The three of us had Shai Gilgeous-Alexander of the Oklahoma City Thunder as the best player. And then that prompted you to ask on Monday's content call, who's going to be the best player in 2029? And I remember saying to everybody, well, there's only one question, and it's about health, right? And then you were like, that's exactly, because I knew who you were talking about, and that being Victor Wembanyama. I mean, he's already, as I said the other day, 95th percentile in EPM as a rookie. He has the best defensive EPM metrics ever by any 20-year-old. So he's already that good. So it's just a matter of him being healthy. And, you know, the him being in the place where he can lead and impact to winning. We all agree that he is that guy. And so I titled this part of this show, it's Wemby's world, right? And we're all just squirrels trying to live in it. And I love that part in the story where you wrote, I think, against the Warriors, they played them in that kind of home and away series. They won in Golden State, and then I think the Warriors won in San Antonio. And
Wemby didn't play in Golden State.
Yes, Wemby did not play in Golden State. Trace Davis, Jackson Davis dunked on him. And, you know, the Warriors bench got all crazy because whenever you dunk on a 7'4" guy, it's a huge deal. But I love Wemby after his quote. He's like, I dunk on a lot of people. A lot of people dunk on me. He's like, but I think people dunk on me a lot less. Like, you know, like something of that nature. He's like, so I'm pretty good with that. Right. And I know you as a coach love that about him because that's competitiveness. The whole idea of like, I've never been dunked on, I'm going to probably guess because you never tried to block a shot or play defense, right? Because if you have, you're going to get dunked on. And you love that he's competitive enough. I'm okay with getting dunked on. It's fine. It won't happen a lot.
I always loved Patrick Ewing because he got dunked on all the time. And he's blocked plenty of shots. It's why I hate the culture of, when a guy breaks your ankles,
right,
whatever.
Right.
Because I don't want the players to be inhibited to try.
Correct.
We're trying to get them to compete no matter what. The fans don't get it. They don't know any better. The average fan, obviously not every fan. Wemby, yeah, I thought his answer was great. Like, whatever. This is what every player understands. Like, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, he's just an incredible talent. Really just extraordinary.
And
there's a reason why we said best prospect of all time.
You sure did. And he does something every game, Dave, where I'm like, how the fuck did you get that ball in the basket? And it's like, but it's just geometry. I'm like, oh, well, because you're so much taller than everybody else. That's how you got it there. I'm like,
it really is a huge advantage to be super tall and long.
Oh my God.
He's skilled. He's athletic. He cares. He wants to win. Like, I don't see a flaw.
He does. I remember, David, early in the season, I asked you, I was like, oh, but David, San Antonio, like, how's this losing going to affect him and bother him? And you were not worried. You're like, it's fine. He'll be okay. Because I thought, you know, if you're not used to losing that much, and I knew they were going to lose a ton because you're just not good as a team. Like, how does that fuck up
like your 14 wins on the year.
Right. How does that? That's got to, the best, just going to get to you, but not in a negative way for him. Like, he's gotten better this season. The shooting, like, he shot 40% last month.
Way better.
Like, yeah. And that's a testament to how good he wants to be.
Yeah, no, he's got I mean, he's got a Michael Jordan mentality, a Kobe mentality, a LeBron mentality, because he passes the ball well. He
does.
He's just 7'4". Yeah, and 8-foot wingspan. Yeah, he's five. What is he? When we block shots, like 3-something.
Oh, yeah, game. Over 3, almost 4. But he's ridiculous.
He's had months with 5. Yeah,
crazy.
He's going to be the Spurs are going to have to make some moves.
Oh,
to make sure they surround him with the players they need. Because Team Wemby won't put up with it.
I can see that.
They're not married to the Spurs. They're going to have to, like, if they want Pop fired, he'll get fired. Like, I'm telling you, he's that player. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting if a year from now, Wemby's not feeling Pop will step down. Hey, I don't think he'll make a big deal of it.
Right.
He'll just realize, okay, I'm just going to retire, move up the ranks, whatever. Yeah, they're just not going to, they can't just sail. They've been bad last year to get him. Mm-hmm. Team next year, they got to make some moves for that.
Do you have like a cord pop out or something of your microphone? Because you're all of a sudden your levels changed there. It was weird.
Really?
Yeah, it's okay. I was thinking about this because you mentioned, you know, Team Wemby won't stand for this. You know, and as you know, development is not linear, right? Like that's not, you don't always do the trend lineup. But let's assume next year he's an all-star caliber player, which is
possible. He's gonna be an all-star.
Okay, that's possible. We can see that. That means that team's, if a 7-foot-4 person who can impact the game on both ends like he is, that's a team that should start winning lots of games now. So this isn't like they have to probably start thinking this summer, okay, what do we do, right, to get ourselves ready and in contention.
All right, do I sound better now?
Yeah.
Okay, I have a feeling the camp is over there. I think they're feeling it. I think they're feeling it. Let me rephrase what I said. I have a feeling they know camp is over from what I'm hearing. They recognize we got to win next year or Team Wemby is going to be very upset. Just like New Orleans was worried about Zion, the Spurs have even more a reason to worry. He's better and he's not from America and he don't give a fuck about any of this shit. Like, get some guys around me. Let's get this right or I'm going to play my 4 years out, and I'm gone.
Yeah. No, it'll be interesting to see what San Antonio does this summer, and also to see what Victor does this summer, playing for Team Paris in the Olympics. All right, David, top five time. Usually I'm pretty confident we have the same five. I'm going to be confident again that we have the same five. All right, who's on your five line this week?
They had a bad loss, I think, last night, but I'm still going to give my Pelicans the number 5 spot. Yep.
See, I think we're mind melding. Pelicans are my 5 team. No, we're gonna mess up here. I know. Who's on your 4 line?
I have to. It wasn't easy. The first 3 are the easy ones. I thought. I'm happy with what Minnesota's trying to do without Kat. So I got him a 4.
Because they weren't. I have Minnesota because you took them out last week because Kat got hurt. You're like, well, forget it.
No, they're doing it. They're doing defensively. All right. I have OKC at 3. Denver, yes, 2.
Correct.
Yeah. This is what's supposed to happen.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, Boston. We're supposed to streamline now. Mm-hmm. The Clippers have been, they had every chance. Cleveland, 2. Cleveland's missing guys, obviously, with Donovan. This is the Sixers, you know, no chance.
Yep.
Yeah, this is the way it's been. And Milwaukee. Milwaukee is I would make them honorable mention or even tie with 5 with New Orleans if I wanted to.
Denver is starting to, you know, I keep going on the car on cruise control. They're shifting, David. It's like, oh, now we're in first place in the West. And like, there is and look, again, just because they won last year doesn't mean they'll win this year. But there is a confidence they have at that they know who, that 5 unit, they know exactly who they are and what they want to run every single time down floor and what their defensive principles are. And in every game, you see it. Like that game against Miami last night. Ooh, Heat go up 2-3. It's going to make him run. No, here comes Denver down. Okay. Boom, boom, boom. Here we go. Murray, Jokic, pick and roll action. Reggie Jackson off the bench. Screen by Jokic. 3. It's like, okay. Like, they just kind of know, right? And they have that belief in that we know who we are and we're fine. We trust our 5, which is why I know we both love to see their 5 versus Boston's 5 in a 7-game series. I think that would be really fun. But we're a long way away from that.
That's for sure. But yeah, they're, if Jokic, as I said, if Jokic wants to be the world's best player, he will be.
Yeah.
Not everyone can say that. Only he can say that. With Embiid out, Jokic can say that.
Yes, for sure. All right, everybody. Enjoy the weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Take care.